After I left last Monday, after giving the talk on money, I felt maybe the talk was a little bit inadequate, or I left some, at least one piece out that would have been important to just mention, at least acknowledged, is that the subject of money is a source of a lot of suffering for a lot of people. And it's a painful subject, and exploring it last week a little bit was to help us perhaps become a little more conscious of the issues around the money and how to use money as a mindfulness tool, mindfulness spell. And I've been thinking a lot about our suffering the last few weeks, and impressed over and over again by how much suffering there is in the world and in ourselves. And I've had, it happens periodically that someone comes to me and they say their life has been difficult, there's been a lot of suffering or something, and that it was such a relief to come to a Buddhist environment and to discover Buddhism where there was some acknowledgement that there is suffering. That suffering wasn't trying, people weren't trying to pretty it up or avoid it or deny it, or but just saying, well, there is suffering in the world and we need to look at it directly for what it is. And the other side, in the sense of the suffering that we experience, is then the desire for happiness. And the Buddhist path is a path that is supposed to lead us to happiness, but not by some magic formula that's going to transform or magically our suffering, but rather through, in a sense, going into it and being very honest about it and waking up through it. And it's been reported by many Asian Buddhist teachers who come to the West or who spend a lot of time with Westerners. They report how surprised they are by the amount of suffering they see in Westerners. It isn't, I mean, Buddhism is designed to address and meet suffering. And so I'm sure that the Asians suffer quite a bit, since that's, I mean, Buddhism arose out of that culture. I don't think they're different than we are in many ways. However, the Asian teachers are surprised by the degree and the severity by which Westerners and Americans suffer so much. And there's a famous story now that's been told many times. I've told it here. Maybe it happened several times, but the story is with the Dalai Lama. Apparently, the first one of the versions of the story was he was meeting with Western psychotherapists, and they were trying to explain to the Dalai Lama about how feelings of lack of self-worth are epidemic in the West, and he kind of couldn't understand what they meant, or self-hate. You know, what is self-hate supposed to mean? He couldn't grok it. And there was a lot of discussion between the translator and Dalai Lama until finally Dalai Lama was finally begin to understand. And the story is that's told is he started crying when he realized the gravity of suffering, that the amount of self-hate in our Western culture. And in one version of the story, he goes around to these different psychotherapists and says, "Is this true for you too?" And the person goes, "Yes." And he's amazed. He goes to the next person, "Is this true for you?" "Yes." And he's just amazed. And other Buddhist teachers have also made the same comment, Asian Buddhist teachers. There seems to be a tremendous amount of alienation in our culture. It seems like alienation is kind of a child of Western civilization. Lack of self-worth, self-esteem, a lot of self-hate, a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, a tremendous amount of longing. Tremendous amount of alienation from oneself, self-estrangement, people who are not really in touch with themselves, frightened of themselves, feeling of emptiness. And I don't bring this up now because, you know, I want to, you know, just, I bring it up because I also am in some ways quite amazed by the degree of suffering that we find in our culture. And as a meditation teacher, where I meet people, you know, I'll meet a lot of people who come, and it's a beautiful calling to be a meditation teacher, because you meet a tremendous amount of honest people. All these people will come and be very honest with you about where they're at in their life and trying to work very diligently with their life. And what I hear over and over again is people suffer. And deep, deep, deep wounds of suffering. And the calling that I feel to the calling that has brought me into Buddhist practice and has brought me now to the point where I'm now also teaching Buddhism was very much a calling to respond to that suffering in the world. It says the proximate cause for compassion is suffering, is experience of suffering. And so suffering is something which has motivated me deeply in my life, motivated me to practice, motivated me to kind of decide what to do with my whole life, kind of my calling for myself. And yet, it's, you know, we don't want to necessarily hear about suffering. We don't want to talk about it so much because it's kind of a downer. You know, please give me a break. I'd rather laugh. I'd rather have a good time. I'd rather be inspired. I'd rather hear beautiful platitudes of wonderful spiritual advice and leave feeling quite good. And but I'm left in the position, since I meet so many people and since I meet myself regularly, to see that there's a tremendous amount of suffering. A tremendous amount. And then into this world of suffering, we come and we offer this practice, the mindfulness practice, which in and of itself is a very simple practice. It's very, very simply just simply noticing, being aware of what's happening and not reacting to that, allowing oneself to experience and notice what's happening and not either pushing it away or holding on to it. And I say that often. And another way that sometimes teachers kind of talk about how simple it might be, and this was used during the retreat that I just recently taught, is teachers will make the distinction between being and doing, and how many of us in our culture and our lives are caught up in doing, doing mode, and trying to accomplish a lot of things and being utilitarian and running around being as efficient as we can and not really having a time to do anything really proper except run around and be harried. And the opposite of doing is supposed to be being, a sense of we're already in a sense full, complete in ourselves, that our doing doesn't come from a lack, a sense of inadequacy, a sense of trying to fill some great emptiness or void. But our doing comes from a kind of contentness or fullness or feeling that we're adequate, we're full, we're perfect in a sense as we are. That it's okay to relax and just be. So the being and doing mode. So it was encouraged at the beginning of this 10-day retreat I taught for people to be more in the being mode during the retreat and not the doing mode. And many people, kind of, there is this kind of switch for people, and it's a tremendous relief for many people to come on retreat and just kind of stop this frantic run. Usually the first day they're tired. But once the tiredness is overcome, then it's such a relief just to kind of be in a place where you can just be and not have to be somebody, make yourself into somebody, protect yourself from everybody, and all the ways that we kind of are doing all the time. And so it's said often, and I say it often, that the mindfulness practice is very simple. It's kind of simple doing, simply being aware in the midst of stuff. And that the mindfulness, I say often, you know, the means and the goal is the same thing in mindfulness. That the goal of mindfulness is to be mindful. And how do you be mindful? By being mindful. So it's beautiful. When you do it, you've done it. So it sounds very simple and very nice, maybe a bit too cute. However, in the midst of this not doing, in the midst of being, in a sense, or just being mindful, being aware in the midst of stuff, something tremendous begins happening. And sometimes I like to talk about it as a byproduct, because if you take it as something you're supposed to be doing, you're supposed to be accomplishing and creating, then it becomes an agenda, something we want to try to do. And then we start doing, and we wrap ourselves up in the doing, and with the self-judgment that comes when we can't do that. But something does happen. And it's, the Buddhist texts talk about this, that the just simply bringing awareness and mindfulness in a very diligent way to our life brings other qualities of our psychology, of our inner development, are awakened and developed and become quite strong. And you can see this, especially a teacher can see this more than sometimes the students. You can see this on longer retreats, but it happens just as much people sitting, having a daily sitting practice, sitting every day at home and going sitting regularly week, month, year after year. And you see, I see that it takes a tremendous amount of courage, for example, to do a 10-day retreat. And I see a tremendous amount of courage being manifested, being arisen, in order to sit there in the midst of the suffering that arises, in the midst of all the anxiety and fear and things that arise. And we usually don't say that, that it takes a lot of courage to go on a retreat. Partly because you never go, maybe, but partly because it gives maybe a little bit the wrong message. Then you have to be kind of macho. You know, it's like a macho approach to spirituality. You hear this word courage, and people get the wrong idea. They have to tough it out. So we just say, be kind. We say the opposite. Be very kind, be very gentle to yourself, be compassionate, try to be mindful as you can. But then people try to do that, and what happens is they meet all their insecurities, their anxieties, their fears, all the places in which awareness is restricted, all the places where awareness gets stuck. Those are the places where we tend to suffer. And since awareness practice is about opening awareness up to be whole, it's naturally going to come and meet those places where it's stuck. That's, it's, as it expands, it meets those places. Perhaps on these retreats, the practitioners there, they don't think of themselves as being courageous. They just think they're trying to cope. But I feel a tremendous amount of courage. But one of the things that's beautiful things is a kind of courage or kind of confidence develops. So one of the things that develops is confidence. After doing this for a while, you develop a confidence that you can sit there with your difficulties. You can sit there with your suffering. That is something powerful, to have that kind of confidence. A sense of commitment. Commitment is something that's developed. And so sitting there day after day with the practice develops commitment, develops discipline. It develops honesty. You have to be tremendously honest to be able to sit and just do rather than just be rather than do. You have to be able to recognize very honestly all the attempts of the mind to try to be something, try to do, create something, try to become an identity, to try to run away, try to hide from oneself. You have to be very, very honest about this. If you're not completely honest when you do mindfulness, you add a lot more unnecessary suffering. We develop patience as we sit. So there's a lot of things get developed. And one of the classic models or descriptions of what gets developed in mindfulness practice is in a list of things called the five, usually in English it's translated as the five faculties. And the five faculties, maybe a better word is the five potentials. These five potentials we have within us that are turned into powers, turned into the five powers. And that's, people are unambiguous about that translation. There's five faculties or five potentials that as you develop them, as you develop mindfulness practice, they turn into these five powers that we then have as powers that we can use. Again, there's a development of certain qualities. And my teachers in Asia used to love to say that these powers come naturally as a byproduct of simply doing mindfulness. But sometimes they can be imbalanced, and you need to look at them and see what needs to be balanced. And the classic way of talking about these five potentials and powers in English is to refer to them as faith, concentration, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And I've been thinking recently that perhaps there's maybe some other ways of translating this that kind of make it come alive a little bit more for us. That rather than maybe translating as faith, it's a power of confidence. Rather than translating as energy, it's the power of engagement. Rather than translating as mindfulness is pretty good. I don't want to change that. but awareness, recognition, or maybe a good word, maybe another word for mindfulness is simply honesty. So we're developing honesty. And another word for concentration is what is discipline, is commitment, is sustaining attention, is involvement. And and wisdom could be understanding, perhaps, understanding well what's going on. And mindfulness, I think, brings up these five qualities. They become powers for us: confidence, engagement, honesty, concentration or commitment, and understanding. And if we told you, go, do your practice and develop those, many of us would wrap ourselves up in knots. You know, how do you do that? And am I supposed to do that? I'm not doing it well enough, and now I'm inadequate again. But these things develop naturally as we try to bring mindfulness to our experience. Mindfulness also has the power in and of itself to reappropriate aspects of our being which we have disassociated from ourselves or cut off from ourselves. Part of the function of mindfulness is to reappropriate everything so we can become whole. It's not really difficult to become fully enlightened unless everything is reappropriated, all the different aspects of ourselves. So we just sit there and we just do this doing practice, this mindfulness, just noticing, but it's kind of like a vacuum cleaner, and we suck up into awareness all those parts of our being which are disembodied, disappropriated, kind of kept at a distance. Both the, you know, sometimes called the shadow sides of our life, both the beautiful and the painful. So we talk just about mindfulness, and we're a mindfulness tradition, and you go do mindfulness retreats with us. But it's sometimes mindfulness is not enough. And one of the messages I think that gets across in our tradition in the West is that we primarily are teaching mindfulness. And mindfulness is like the main heart of the spiritual practice, or mindfulness maybe is enough in and of itself. And I've talked about this in the past, that what's happened is that we've gone to Asia and we've studied a very narrow tradition. We studied a very narrow part of a wide religious tradition. And we studied the mindfulness part because the mindfulness part was the part that was considered to be the precursor, the necessary precursor or foundation for becoming free, becoming liberated or enlightened. So a lot of people give me the enlightenment making stuff. Don't forget about everything else. And for some people, it works quite well to do mindfulness straight out, and it develops a lot of wonderful qualities. But the way that mindfulness is offered in the religious tradition that it comes from, the Theravadan tradition, it's offered as part of a path. And Theravadan Buddhism, the Buddhism of mindfulness practice, is a path-oriented practice where you follow a path of development. And it's a developmental path, might be fair to call it. It's a path of training, of development. And what this implies is that we are developing certain qualities within us, not just simply developing mindfulness. Without the development, without having in place certain mature, developed qualities of our spiritual being, of our human being, it's very difficult to engage properly in mindfulness practice, to take it all the way as far as it's meant to take us. So therefore, the tradition offers things to do before you do mindfulness practice. And in Asia, mindfulness practice is often not taught as, you know, you come off the street and you are taught mindfulness practice. But rather you're taught these things that develop these strengths within you so that you're ready to do mindfulness practice. So, and I think it's interesting, so there's a number of different descriptions of this developmental process, or a number of different models of how the path unfolds. One of them, which I'm not going to talk about tonight, is what's called the Eightfold Path, a very famous teaching in Buddhism. But I found it very interesting that this famous Eightfold Path in Buddhism has two things which are considered to be the precursor of the Eightfold Path, two things which need to kind of be in place or very helpful to have in place before you engage yourself in the Eightfold Path. And those are friendships and contentment. Now, what do you think of that? So even before you kind of start your spiritual practice, you need to have those two in place: contentment and friendships. That's quite a statement, isn't it? So you know, what do we do with that? So friendship and contentment. So we need to have that, at least that kind of development, kind of somewhat. It helps to have that there. So then the first kind of entry into the path, and this gradual description of the path, starts with aspiration, starts with intention, aspiring to be happy, aspiring to be free of suffering, aspiring to become liberated. And that's considered in Buddhism to be a very beautiful aspiration, provided it's not tied up with our self-image. That's tied up with the idea that I need to be the most liberated person in Palo Alto so that you fill in the blank, so that people admire me or give me lots of money or, you know, bow down on their knees to me or whatever you think that people should do to enlighten people. So as long as it's not tied up in our self-image, that's considered to be a very beautiful, not only beautiful, but extremely precious thing to have, that aspiration to be happy, to be free of our suffering, to want to engage in it. And it starts there. And sometimes it's known, and sometimes it's unknown, that aspiration. There are some people who are throw themselves into practice, and they don't really know where that aspiration or intention comes from. They simply just do it. After the aspiration, the next developmental stage is the practice of generosity. And I've talked plenty about this, I think, here, but generosity in this sense develops certain qualities within us which are considered indispensable for creating a foundation for doing really serious mindfulness practice. So generosity develops, for example, generosity. With generosity develops open-heartedness. Generosity helps develop non-clinging. It's very hard to be generous if you're still holding on. So you have to kind of open your hand to let things leave. Generosity develops connectedness with others. I think if you're appropriately and sensitively generous, you're sensitive to the people around you, to your friends around you. And so you begin understanding, begin developing a network of connections with other people. Because generosity happens in a network of people. So I think it's very nice that one of the earliest levels of development of a spiritual path happens in connecting you with other people. So you're creating connectedness. And that's considered very important, developmental of friendships, of connectedness, of sensitivity to other people. What are some other qualities get developed when we are generous? Help me out. What do you think happens?
Compassion.
Compassion, mm-hmm. Yes. What else?
Non-clinging.
Non-clinging.
Forgiveness.
Energy gets freed up.
Freeing up of energy. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It,
beautiful. Yes.
Getting with the flow of life.
Uh-huh. Being connected and flowing along. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Selflessness.
Selflessness. Uh-huh. Yes.
More of a compassion for the needy parts of oneself.
Compassion for oneself, needy parts in oneself. Beautiful. You can be generous to yourself, too.
Non-judgmental.
Beautiful.
Accepting generosity from others and learning to deal with that successfully.
Beautiful.
Simplicity.
Simplicity. Uh-huh.
Non-attachment to outcome, giving without intending something to come out of it or use for whatever it is you're giving.
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
Being more aware of suffering.
That's for sure. One of the ways that generosity works as a practice is if you take it on as a practice, you notice where you're not generous, where you're holding back, where you're clinging. And that's very valuable. It's not valuable so you can judge yourself and criticize yourself, but it's valuable to notice where we're holding ourselves. It's invaluable. Because Buddhism is about being honest about where we're at. And that's one of the ways to find out where we're at. That's more than enough for a lifetime. I guess that's all. You know, it's said in Buddhism that generosity is the only practice you really need to do. If you just figure out generosity thoroughly, that's enough. The next one, after the practice of generosity, is the practice of ethics. And the ethics is primarily following the five precepts, but it can mean a lot more things also. But just to be simple here tonight, it means, you know, not to harm or take life, not to take what is not given, not to lie, not to abuse sexuality, and not to indulge in intoxicants. And we can turn those around on themselves in a sense and look at what are the positive qualities that living such an ethical life brings. And perhaps, you know, not killing, with that comes respect for life forms around us. Not stealing, it's said traditionally cultivates generosity, to cultivate non-clinging, non-attachment, non-greed. It cultivates contentment, it says. Not lying, you know, it cultivates honesty. Not abusing sexuality, perhaps again, contentment. And honesty, and what else? And not abusing intoxicants is maybe cultivating clarity of mind. So those are kind of things that come to my mind sitting here. What are some of the things that you guys think would, what kind of qualities within you are strengthened and developed if you seriously engage in ethical life?
Self-discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Respect for others and for yourself.
Uh-huh. Right. And that is respect for others and oneself. And that in Asia is considered to be, in Asia, that's one of the things that ethics tends to provide people, is a tremendous amount of self-respect and self and happiness in oneself. And you're supposed to be able to look back at your ethical, good ethical deeds of the day, or and just be rejoice in the fact that you haven't killed anyone, or rejoice in the fact that you haven't lied, or you tried not to lie. Or, I mean, ethical conduct should be a source of rejoicing. Someone else? Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Perhaps the healing of the self-hatred you referenced earlier.
Yes, I think so.
Simplicity.
Also simplicity. Elizabeth.
Freedom from dealing with the thoughts that you have to deal with if you have broken any of those precepts.
Simplicity of mind.
Just the struggle brings a tremendous amount of self-awareness.
Just like with generosity, I think. And
the preciousness of all life.
Uh-huh. The preciousness of all life.
There's space around your actions, and there's space around other people's parameters, and you don't trod on it. It's not withholding, but it's just an acknowledgement of space.
I think that's beautiful. And a modern psychological, perhaps, way of talking about this is discovering appropriate boundaries.
Yeah.
Other people's boundaries and one's own. Very important developmental process. Yes?
Trust.
Uh-huh, trust. Yes?
Possibility
of intimacy, that's for sure. The friendship part again. So there are some of these qualities then, in a sense, that maybe we're not cultivating them actively, but they're kind of byproducts. They arise from the practice of generosity, from the practice of ethics. And they create a kind of strength within us, like a strength of self-worth, of self-respect, of discipline, of awareness, of patience, many things. And all that strength then makes it a lot easier to sit down and be rather than do. If you try to be rather than do, when we're not developmentally kind of ready for it and strong enough for it, it's very weak. It's kind of very precarious and unstable. And Now what happens, I think, when people do mindfulness practice is that in fact they develop all those things, because there's the confrontation of what goes on in our life. We kind of learn what we need to learn, oftentimes. But what I see happening often enough is that a lot of people come to do mindfulness practice, and maybe it's fine for them to do mindfulness practice. I would never say that someone shouldn't do mindfulness practice. But I think some people need to do other things just as much. Some people need to do the other developmental work so that they're not falling back always into the hole of feeling of inadequate or feeling lack of self-worth or lack of dignity or lack of, or feeling self-hate or feeling shame or feeling embarrassed or whatever. So we need to develop these things. And this, and the Theravada tradition, as a religious tradition, offers this kind of gradual training that I think we need to take seriously. That isn't just simply do mindfulness practice. So it offers a path. And I kind of think of the path as being a spiral, that there isn't actually any formal beginning and formal ending of it, but rather all of us kind of are spiraling around and around, and we find ourselves at different points in our life, and some points where we, you know, intention and really strengthening our intentions, discovering, clarifying our intention is the important point. Other times it's generosity, which is an important developmental stage or what needs to be cultivated or learned. Other points is our ethics, and we explore that. And other points is really throwing yourself into the world of mindfulness so you become happier and freer. And for some people, it's not even linear, you know, even like a spiral. It's just simply, you know, it's just, for some people, it's just a soup, a stew of things, and they're doing all of them kind of haphazardly all together. I mean, that's where most of us are at. Or some people, they just jump around. But still, the spiritual practice of mindfulness is offered so often as a simple thing, as if nothing's supposed to happen. Being no one going nowhere, right? But actually, it involves a development of tremendous spiritual potential or psychological qualities within us. And I think we shouldn't forget that. Because all of us also need to take responsibility for all the different elements of who we are. So... So hopefully, you know, a teacher, when you go talk to a teacher sometimes will help us, you know, sort out, you know, what actually are we needing to do? Do we need just to do more mindfulness practice, or do we need to look more carefully at our intention, our motivation? Do we need to look more carefully at the way we live our life, more broadly than just, you know, being mindful or not mindful? And perhaps there's a certain amount of unnecessary suffering that goes on sometimes by students of mindfulness when they try to solely look at their spiritual practice in terms of mindfulness practice itself. And part of the reason for this is that it's very easy with mindfulness to shade into self-consciousness. And because they're kind of in the same area, right? I mean, mindfulness is to be aware of what's happening. Self-consciousness is to be aware of what's happening and to judge oneself and one's image and everything by that. And so those of us who have a habit of being self-conscious will often use mindfulness in a self-conscious way. So it can be a little bit risky at times, the mindfulness practice, unless we understand these things. So it's a path. And I'm very fond of Jack Kornfield's little question. I think he took it from Carlos Castaneda. Is that when you encounter a spiritual path or your particular path, you should ask, does it have heart? Is it a path with heart? Is it a path that brings love, compassion, connectedness, friendship, awareness, happiness, honesty? Does it bring these qualities for you? And if it doesn't, you should take a serious look at it and maybe chuck it. So, any comments or questions? Yes.
I was curious when you mentioned that you thought that it was appropriate to become aware of our boundaries, and that was a good thing. And I realize in our day-to-day life that's important, but from the other side, I thought there was a value in essentially removing the boundaries to be able to essentially not, I mean, because the boundaries essentially are somewhat defining our small self and, mm-hmm. and who we are versus the others, and we see the differences. Mm-hmm. And so.
It's a good point. I mean, I'm not that conversant with how in psychology the word boundaries is used, but in Buddhism, of course, any kind of boundaries, in a sense that they keep us separate from others or shut us off or keep us separate, it needs to be overcome. But the danger is that if our sense of separateness is relaxed without a strong awareness of who we are and a strong awareness of our reactions, our responses, our feelings, our thoughts and everything, then we begin responding sometimes inappropriately to the world around us. We either assert ourselves onto others too strongly, or we allow others to assert themselves on us too strongly. So appropriate sense of space or boundaries, appropriate sense of relatedness to others comes from self-awareness and comes from being aware of others and respecting others. And perhaps we can call that boundaries if we don't think of boundaries as being walls. Does that make sense? So one of the things I talk about sometimes is that we're trying in Buddhism, in a sense, to overcome self-centeredness. Self-centeredness is considered to be one of the great sources of suffering. We want to replace it not with what we want to replace it with is what I call situation-centeredness. We still want to be centered, and we want to be centered in the situation we find ourselves in, but the situation needs to be centered on us, but not in a self-centered way, but rather centered here, where the awareness of what's happening begins within and it goes out from here. So we're completely aware of our reactions and responses to the world around us and the way the world affects us. And if we can do that, have that kind of awareness, then I believe we don't really need to have boundaries. And self-centeredness is, you safely let go of self-centeredness. So that's why mindfulness is very, very important, because we're developing this many things, but one of the things we're developing is awareness of what our responses and reactions are. Some of the ones we become aware of is how we respond by putting up walls, how we respond by creating a self-image that the world centers around. As we let go of that, we're replacing that, in a sense, with a different kind, with awareness of ourselves that is not image-centered. And that's necessary. And what happens to people who don't have that sense of what's of themselves strong enough, when they let go of their boundaries, they become very unskillful in the world. Yes.
I have a question about the context in which, the social context in which the ethical behavior, or the focus on ethical behavior, is taught before mindfulness. Because I'd also heard that there's not a strong lay tradition of mindfulness in Asian society. It's usually somebody coming in to a monastery, being a monk. So what's the condition? Is this for monks or for lay people who want to dabble? Or is it part of the cultural tradition that...
The way that the practice is offered now in Asia is it's offered very freely to lay people. And it's quite beautiful to go to countries like Burma and see that people spend their vacations in meditation monasteries. I mean, not just a few people. I mean, you can go to I was in one monastery where they're during the kind of their equivalent of Easter break, there were 5,000 lay people for a week meditating. It was a powerhouse, you know, of meditators. So it's definitely offered to people, to lay people, and the teachers will say over and over again, you have to practice ethics. monks and nuns, by becoming monks and nuns, bind themselves to ethical norms of being ethical. And actually, the precepts for monks and nuns are much greater than what it is for lay people. So their life is being negotiated much more thoroughly in the context of ethics. And often, traditionally, even a monk or nun is sometimes not taught mindfulness practice as soon as they're ordained, but might spend 5 years doing kind of this preparatory work of establishing a strong ethical foundation, a strong foundation in good behavior and in faith and understanding. And only when they do that, they have enough of that, then they're taught to mindfulness.
One of the reasons I asked the question is that, you know, I wonder how, it seems to me that if, as you're practicing ethical behavior, there's a certain mindfulness that you have to bring to your life in order to see that you're acting in a non-ethical fashion. So it's not maybe that you have to sit down and meditate to get that self-awareness, but it certainly seems to me that if you have a sitting practice, that it facilitates
that. Right. Definitely. It definitely facilitates, and mindfulness almost never hurts in and of itself. It really helps everything. But for example, there are some people for whom it's just impossible for them to sit down and be still and pay attention. But they can learn to pay attention if they're taught, you know, don't kill anything, or don't steal, or please, you know, keep your room clean. You know, please keep your room clean, you're told, or sweep the courtyard. And well, okay, I can do that, and it requires mindfulness. And because it requires mindfulness, mindfulness is developed. So all these things develop mindfulness. What happens in the West is that we tend to teach mindfulness first. And as mindfulness gets developed in us, it becomes clearer and clearer to us that the others need to be in place also. So for us, it tends to kind of be the other way around. We see the value of ethics and generosity more directly, whereas perhaps the way it's taught in Asia, the higher spiritual value of it is not seen right away. People often do it on faith. And then eventually they'll get to the mindfulness practice. And you know, each of us will start where we think is appropriate. And most of us start with mindfulness practice. And I think part of the beauty of Buddhist practice, I feel, is the point is we're supposed to start with where we are, start with ourselves, and then find what spiritual practices, find what practices within Buddhism support you in your aspiration. It starts with aspiration, in a sense, and aspiration starts with yourself, where you're at. So rather than imposing something like Buddhism on yourself, what you want to do is, in a sense, start with yourself, understand yourself, be honest with yourself, and then see how Buddhism can support the deepest aspirations we have. But it's kind of circular, isn't it? Now, one of the reasons why we don't talk so much about the developmental models or gradual trainings in the West is because it's so easy for us to get tied up with our self-consciousness and get tied into knots with our lack of self-worth and lack of self-esteem and self-criticism. And what most of us need here in the West is to practice, is to hear what is actually true, is that in a sense, we're just fine the way we are. Our fundamental sense of self-worth is already here. We don't have to do anything to have it. And so there's a tremendous emphasis on acceptance, self-acceptance, on love and self-love, on loving kindness in these circles, because that's what many of us in our culture need to learn. So perhaps we need to add another piece to the developmental model. And maybe we need to start with loving kindness or start with acceptance. But acceptance is just another way of talking about mindfulness. So it's all a mess. So please be kind to yourself, and please be very accepting and loving, and realize that you're completely wonderful people as you are, and that all your sense of self-worth that you ever need, you already have. And relax. So I hope this was okay talk. I felt a lot of passion because I've been sitting in a world of suffering so much lately, And I felt it was important for me to say these things. So thank you very much. And we meet next week, even though it's Memorial Day.
Labor Day.
Labor Day.